Of course, home ec, she calls it cotillion. Their teacher, Mrs. Olga Schwingel, the wife of the local pharmacist, tries to teach these small-town girls manners and etiquette. She shows them how to be proper ladies, how to take up the habits necessary to join the faraway, sophisticated world. To brush their hair each night 100 times, to brush their teeth 50 times up and down, to chew each bite at least 34 times. To stand up straight, don't lean, don't hunch, make eye contact, smile when being spoken to. When she says cotillion, she pronounces it with a French affect, cotillot. We must rinse that farm off you, Mrs. Schwingel says, even to the girls who do not live on farms. What we need is some elegance. And she'll put on a record, chamber music or a waltz, and say, you girls are so lucky to have me here. She teaches them things their mothers know nothing about, what kinds of glasses to serve wine in or scotch, the difference between a dinner fork and a salad fork, where all these things belong in a proper place setting, which direction the blade of the knife should face, how to sit without putting your elbows on the table, how to approach a table, how to leave one, how to gracefully accept a compliment, how to sit when a man pushes the seat in behind you, how to make a good cup of coffee, how to serve it properly, how to set out sugar cubes in adorable little pyramids on fragile-looking painted china, the likes of which Faye has never seen in her own home. Mrs. Schwingel teaches them how to host a dinner party, how to cook for a dinner party, how to make pleasing conversation with dinner guests, how to create the sophisticated dishes she insists the wives on the East Coast are right now making, mostly involving some kind of gelatin, some kind of lettuce trim, some kind of food within another food conceit. Shrimp salad in an avocado ring mold, pineapple and lime gelatin served with cream cheese, cabbage suspended in jellied bouillon, peaches split and filled with blueberries, canned pear halves covered in shredded yellow cheese, pineapple boats filled with cocktail sauce, olive pimento mousse, chicken salad molded into white warheads, tuna squares, lemon salmon towers, ham-wrapped cantaloupe balls. These are the new and fabulous dishes that ladies of culture are serving. America has fallen in love with these foods, modern, exciting, unnatural. Mrs. Schwingel has been to New York City. She has been to Chicago's Gold Coast. She goes all the way to Dubuque to get her hair done, and when she isn't buying clothes from the catalogs of East Coast retailers, she shops the boutiques of Des Moines or Joliet or Peoria. When the weather is pleasant, she announces, "What a wonderful day!" and throws open the classroom shutters so dramatically that Faye expects to see cheerful animated birds flying in from outside. She tells them to enjoy the breeze and the scent of lilacs. They're in bloom, you know. They go collect the flowers and place them around the class in small vases. A lady's house will always have such touches. Today she begins class with her usual exhortation regarding marriage. When I was in college becoming a certified professional secretary, she says, standing powerfully erect, her hands clasped in front of her, I decided to take classes in biology and chemistry. All my teachers wondered why I would do that, why go to all that trouble, why not more typing? She laughs and shakes her head like someone patiently tolerating a fool. I had a plan, she says. I knew since I was a girl that I wanted to marry someone in the medical field. I knew I needed to expand my mind so that I could attract someone in the medical field. If all I could talk about was typing and filing, who in the medical field would be interested in me? She looks at the girl solemnly and profoundly like she is delivering some awful adult truth. Nobody, Mrs. Schwingel says. That's the answer, nobody. And when I met Harold, I knew my science electives really paid off. She smooths her dress. What I'm trying to say is, set big goals. You do not have to settle for marrying a farmer or plumber. You might not be able to marry someone in the medical field, like me, but someone in the accounting field is not out of the question for any of you young ladies, or perhaps business, banking, or finance. Figure out the kind of man you want to marry and arrange your life to make it happen. She asked the girls to think about the kind of husband they want. I want a man who can take me on trips to Acapulco, they say. I want a man who can buy me a convertible. I want a man who is a boss, so I never have to worry about impressing the boss when he drops in because I'm married to him. Mrs. Schwingel teaches them to dream in these terms. You can have a life that includes cruises in the Mediterranean, she says, or you can have a life of bass fishing on the Mississippi. It's your choice, girls, but if you want a better life, you've got to work for it. Do you think your husband will want to talk about stenography? The girls gravely shake their heads no. Faye, this is especially important for you, she says. Chicago will be full of sophisticated men. Faye feels the collective gaze of the class land on her, and she sinks into her chair. They move on to the day's primary lesson, toilets, as in, where are the germs? They are everywhere. And how is it cleaned? Thoroughly, with bleach and ammonia, on our hands and knees. In groups of five, they practice toilet scrubbing in the bathroom. Faye waits her turn with the other girls, who stare out the classroom windows at the boys, who are currently in gym class. Today it's baseball, the boys fielding grounders at shortstop, the thud of the bat, the ball skipping over the dirt as they charge and scoop it up and snap it to first base with that gratifying thwack. This is pleasing to watch. The boys, who act so aloof and nonchalant in real life, who try to be so cool in class, sitting slumped in their chairs, defiant, they perk up like puppies on the baseball field, their movements exaggerated and eager. Charge, stop, catch, pivot, throw. Henry is out there with them. He's not quite quick enough for shortstop, a bit of a lumberer, but he tries nonetheless. He slaps his fist into his mitt, shouts encouraging things. The boys know the girls watch them during practice. They know and they like it. Faye sits on a stool at one of the cooking stations, her elbows on the dark brown metal stovetop. Beneath her is a generation of culinary disasters. Burned tomato sauces, burned pancake batters, roasted eggs and puddings, fossils now on the burners, black and carbonized. An old scorching that not even their teacher's most penetrating potions can remedy. Faye runs her hand across the char, feels the roughness on her fingertips. She watches the boys. Watches the girls watch the boys. Watches, for example, Margaret Schwingle, the teacher's daughter with her fair, slightly plump face, expensive wool sweater, nylons, shiny black shoes, blonde hair extravagantly curled, and the assembly that clings to Margaret, her disciples, who all wear the same silver click bands on their fingers, who help arrange Margaret's hairdo in the morning, fetch her Cokes and candy in the cafeteria, and spread hateful rumors about her enemies. Faye and Margaret don't talk. Not since elementary school. They're not unfriendly. Faye has simply receded from her view. Faye has always been intimidated by Margaret, and usually avoids making eye contact. She knows the Schwingles are wealthy, that their huge house sits on a bluff overlooking the river. Margaret is wearing a boy's class ring around her neck, another on her right hand. On her left hand, a gold promise ring. This on a girl who yawns during English class discussions on symbolism. Margaret's quasi-fiancé, her steady since freshman year, is one of those impossible, intolerable boys who's a star at everything. Baseball, football, track and field. He pins his medals to his school jacket, then gives his jacket to Margaret, who walks around school clinking like a wind chime. His name is Jules, and Margaret has stripped him of all his tokens. She's remarkably proud of him. She's watching him right now, in fact, while he waits his turn on the baseball diamond. Meanwhile, she makes fun of the other boys, the clumsy ones, the ones who are not Jules. Oops, she says when a ball squirts under a glove and into the outfield. You forgot something, the few friends around her laugh. It's behind you, fella. She's speaking loud enough for the rest of the room to hear her, but quiet enough that they're not part of the conversation. This is a typical Margaret pose, extroverted, yet also exclusive. A little faster next time, big boy, she says when poor John Novotny, overweight, thickish ankles, a bumbling hippopotamus among the faster boys, doesn't reach a ground ball to his right. Really? Why is he even out there? She says. Or when it's Polly Melick's turn. Little Polly Melick, all of maybe 5 feet tall and 100 pounds, she says, Noodles, go, Noodles! Because of how his arms look. She preys on the fat, the skinny, the short. She preys on the weak. She's a carnivore, Faye thinks. A fangy wolf pup. Then it's Henry's turn. All the girls are waiting, watching. Margaret is watching. They all see him. Henry smacking his glove with his fist and getting into an approximation of an infielder's crouch. Faye suddenly feels very protective of him. She senses that the class wants to be entertained, wants to hear more of Margaret's intoxicating cruelty, like they're rooting for Henry to fail. They can do nothing but watch and hope. and when she looks at Margaret again, she finds Margaret is looking right back at her. And Faye's stomach does a loop. She blushes, her eyes grow wide. She feels somehow that she's already lost at whatever kind of showdown this is, and Margaret's cold scrutiny makes the hierarchy very clear. Margaret can say whatever she wants right now, and Faye cannot stop her. So they're all watching Henry as the coach hits the ball. It bounces across the dirt field, and Henry bounds to his left to retrieve it, and Faye is angry. Not at Margaret, but at Henry. Angry at his imminent public failure, that he put her in this position, in this stupid rivalry with Margaret Schwingle. Angry that she feels responsible for him, accountable for his weaknesses as if they were her own. He seems to be waddling like a toddler, and Faye hates him right now. She's attended enough weddings to know that essential line from the liturgy, and the two shall become one. Everyone seems to think this is really romantic, but Faye has always been appalled by the thought. In this moment, right now, this is why. It's like taking all your fallibility and doubling down. But this is Henry's moment. He's running to fetch a baseball. And wouldn't you know it, he does so flawlessly. Snares the ball, plants his feet, and throws directly and precisely and quickly to first base. Perfect. The archetype of ground ball fielding technique. And the coach claps, and the boys clap, and Margaret says nothing at all. Soon it's their turn in the toilets, and Faye sits on the tile floor feeling miserable. Though the moment passed without incident, Faye was ready for an encounter with Margaret, and her body still registers that tenseness. She's one big exposed nerve right now, her insides still squawking. She had been so ready for a fight that it seemed as if she actually had the fight. And it does not help that Margaret is here with her, in the bathroom, is sitting in the neighboring toilet stall. Faye can feel her presence almost like an oven. The toilet in front of her is spotless and white and shiny and smells like bleach, the work of home ec girls in here moments before. The teacher paces behind them explaining the perils of an unclean toilet. Scabies, salmonella, gonorrhea, various resident microorganisms. "There is no such thing as a too clean toilet," she says. She hands them new scrubbing brushes. They crouch on the floor, some of them sit, and they wash the bowl, jostling the water, foaming the water. They scour and cleanse and rinse. "Remember the handle," Mrs. Schwingle says. "The handle might be the dirtiest of all." The teacher shows them how much bleach to use, how to contort their arms to most effectively clean under the lip of the bowl. She tells the girls how to keep their inevitable future children healthy, how to stop colds from spreading by keeping a clean bathroom, how to prevent toilet germs from infecting the rest of the house. "Germs," she says, "can be propelled into the air when the toilet is flushed, so when you flush, close the cover and step away." Faye is scrubbing when, from the next stall over, Margaret speaks. "He looked cute out there," she says. And Faye doesn't know who she's talking to, finds it unlikely that Margaret would be talking to her, so she keeps scrubbing. "Hello," Margaret says, and she knocks lightly on the wall. "Anybody home?" "What?" "Yes," Faye says. "Hello? Are you talking to me?" Yeah. Then Margaret's face appears beneath the John wall. She's leaning over. She's almost upside down. Her huge blonde curls hang comically off the top of her head. "I was telling you," she says, "that he looked cute out there."
"Who?"
"Henry, duh."
"Oh, right, sorry.
I saw you watching him. You must have thought he looked cute."
"Of course," Faye says.
"Yes, that's what I was thinking."
Margaret looks at Faye's necklace on which she's wearing Henry's ring, his big opal-stoned class ring. She says,
"Are you going to put that ring on your left hand?"
"I don't know."
"If you two were really serious, you'd wear it on your left hand, or he could get another ring, and then you'd have one for your neck and one for your left hand. That's what Jules did."
"Yes, right.
Jules and I are very serious." Faye nods. "We'll be married soon. He has a lot of prospects."
Faye keeps nodding.
"A lot." Their teacher notices the chattering and walks over, hands on hips, saying, "Margaret, why aren't you cleaning?" And Margaret gives Faye this look, conspiratorial, like, "We're in this together," that sort of look, and disappears behind the wall.
"I'm cleaning it mentally, Mom," Margaret says. "I'm visualizing it. I'll remember it better that way." Perhaps if you were as focused as Faye here, you'd be going to the big city, too.
Sorry, Mom.
Your husband, Mrs. Schwingle says, louder now, talking to the whole group, will expect a certain level of household cleanliness. And Faye thinks about the posters on the classroom walls, husbands with their big demands, husbands in hats and coats storming out the door when their wives can't meet basic womanly requirements, husbands in advertisements on television or in magazines. For coffee, how he'll expect you to make a fine pot for his boss, or for cigarettes, how he'll want you to be hip and sophisticated. For the maiden form bra, how he'll expect you to have a womanly figure. And it seems to Faye that this husband creature is the most particular and demanding species in human history. Where does he come from? How do the boys on the baseball field, goofballs, clowns, clumsy as chickens, unsure of themselves, idiots at love, ever become that? The girls are excused. They return to the classroom to summon the next wave. They sit back at their desks and look in boredom outside. The boys are still at it. Some are dirtier now, having found reasons to dive or slide. And Jules is up, that gladiator of a boy with a sugar cookie face. Margaret says, "Go, honey, go, baby," though we can't hear her. Margaret's exaltation is for the girls in the class, so they'll watch. And the grounder comes in at Jules, and he moves for it, moves so fluidly and easily, his feet so fast and sure, not slipping in the dirt like the other boys, as though he moves on some other more tactile earth. And he plants himself in front of the ball, arriving in the correct spot with so much time to spare, relaxed and effortless. The baseball bounces toward his glove, and maybe it hits a rock or a pebble, maybe it strikes an odd indentation in the dirt, who knows? The ball suddenly shoots upward, unexpectedly and crazily, bounces up fast and strikes Jules square in the throat. He drops to the ground, kicking. And the girls in the home economics classroom find this hilarious. They giggle, they laugh, and Margaret turns to them and yells, "Shut up!" She looks so hurt at this moment, so ashamed. She looks like the women in the posters, their husbands abandoning them, frightened, damaged, rejected, that feeling of being unfairly and cruelly judged. Margaret looks like that, and Faye wishes she could take Margaret's vulnerability and embarrassment and bottle it, like deodorant, like cans of germicidal spray. She'd give it to wives everywhere. She'd shoot it at grooms on wedding days. She'd throw bombs of it, like napalm, off the roof and onto the baseball diamond. Then the boys, too, could know how it feels. 5. Faye sits alone, outside after school, a book in her lap, her back pressed against the school's warm, gritty wall, listening through the wall to musicians idly playing. A trumpet runs up a scale to its highest, loudest peak. A xylophone is plinked on its smallest bars. A trombone makes that splatty fart noise only a trombone is capable of. The students of the school orchestra seem to be on a break right now, fooling around between numbers, and so Faye waits and reads. The book is a thin collection of poems by Allen Ginsberg, and she's reading the one about sunflowers again, for maybe the 100th time, each time becoming more convinced that the poem is about her. Well, not really. She knows the poem is really about Ginsberg sitting in the Berkeley Hills, staring out at the water, feeling depressed. But the more she reads it, the more she sees herself in it. When Ginsberg writes about the gnarled steel roots of trees of machinery, he might as well be describing the Chemstar plant. The oily water on the river could easily be the Mississippi. And the sunflower field he describes could just as well be this Iowa cornfield in front of her, separated from the school by a rickety barbed wire fence, the field recently tilled and planted, a rippled blanket of black, wet, slippery earth. By the time school resumes in the fall, the field will be busy with big-shouldered plants, spine straight, corn-armored, and ready, finally, to be hacked down, to crumple weakly where they're chopped at the knees. Faye sits and waits for the orchestra to begin playing again and thinks about this, harvest, and how it always makes her sad, how the cornfields in November look like battlegrounds, the chopped-down plants blanched and bone-like, corn stalks like femurs half-buried and poking sharply out of the ground. After that, the chilly approach of another Iowa winter, the late autumn snow dusting, the first November frost, the desolate January tundra this place becomes. Faye imagines what a Chicago winter would be like, and she imagines it would be better and warmer, heated by all that traffic and movement and concrete and electricity, by all those hot human bodies. Through the wall she hears someone squawking on a reed, and she smiles at that noise, the memory of that noise. She had been a musician once, one of the woodwinds, one of those who crowed her reeds. It's one of the things she gave up after the panic attacks began. That's what the doctors called them, panic attacks, which didn't seem accurate to Faye. It didn't feel like she was panicking. It felt more like she was being forcibly and methodically deactivated all over, like a wall of televisions being turned off, one by one. How the images on each TV shrank to pinholes before disappearing altogether. It felt like that. The narrowing of her vision when an attack began, how she could only really take in and focus on one small thing, a dot in the wider field, usually her shoes. At first it seemed to happen only when she displeased her father, when she did something, like taking those boys to the bomb shelter, that angered him. But then later the attack struck in moments when she might displease him, when she had the opportunity to fail in front of him, even if she had not yet failed. Example: the concert. She had joined the school orchestra after listening to a compelling recording of Peter and the Wolf. She had wanted to play the violin, maybe the cello, but the school had openings only in the woodwinds. They gave her an oboe, dull black, the color rubbed off in places, the keys once silver but now a flat brown, one long deep scratch running down its entire length. Learning the oboe was a calamity of honks and squawks, missed notes, her pinky fingers sliding off the keys because they couldn't yet move independently of the rest of her hand. Yet she liked it. She liked that the oboe gave the tuning note at the beginning of rehearsal. She liked the constancy of that, the hard, solid A she delivered that anchored the whole group. She liked the severe posture needed to play it, sitting up straight, holding it in front of her, elbows at right angles. She even enjoyed the rehearsals, the camaraderie, everyone working toward a common goal, the general feeling of high artistry, the magnificent sound they could make together. For their first concert, each musician would have a very small solo. She practiced hers for months, until the notes were inside her, until she could play her solo perfectly without even looking at the music. The night of the performance, she was all dressed up, and she looked into the audience and saw her mother, who waved, and her father, who was reading the program. And there was something about his concentration, something about the humorless way he studied the program, the way he scrutinized it, that just terrified Faye. A thought popped into her head. What if I screw up? It was something she had never before considered, and suddenly whatever magic she summoned when she practiced could not be summoned now. She could not clear her mind, could not let go as she had let go in rehearsal. Her palms moistened and her fingers grew cold. By intermission she had a headache, a stomach ache, dark patches of sweat under her arms. She felt the urgent need to pee, but once in the bathroom she found that she couldn't. Then during the concert's second half she began to feel dizzy. Her chest was tight. When the conductor pointed his baton to cue her solo, Faye couldn't play. The air stopped in her throat. What she squeezed out was a small cry, a short and helpless wheeze. Now all the faces turned, everyone was looking. She heard music coming from elsewhere, but it sounded far away, like being underwater. The light in the auditorium seemed to dim. She stared at her shoes. She tumbled out of her chair. She blacked out. The doctor said nothing was wrong.
"Nothing medically," they quickly added.
They made her breathe into a brown paper bag and diagnosed her with a chronic nervous condition. Her father looked at her mortified and stricken.
"Why did you do that?" he said. "The whole town was watching."
Which ignited her nerves all over again, his disappointment about her panic attack combined with her anxiety about not having another one in front of him. Then she began having panic attacks even in situations that had nothing to do with her father, in moments that seemed otherwise innocent and even-keeled and calm. She would be having a normal conversation and suddenly this toxic thought would, for no reason, appear, "What if I screw up?" And whatever blithe thing Faye had been saying the moment before was suddenly elevated to catastrophic proportions. Was she being stupid, insensitive, dim-witted, boring? The conversation became a horrible test she could easily fail. She felt a sense of doom combined with those bodily fight-or-flight mechanisms, Headaches, chills, blushing, sweating, hyperventilating, hairs standing on end. Which made everything worse because the only thing more painful than a panic attack was someone else seeing it. Moments when she failed in front of other people, or moments when she felt the potential to fail in front of people. These could trigger an attack. Not every time, but sometimes. Frequent enough that she had adopted a certain self-protective behavior. She became a person who never screwed up. A person who never failed at anything. It was easy. The more afraid Faye felt on the inside, the more perfect she was on the outside. She blunted any possible criticism by being beyond reproach. She remained in people's good graces by being exactly who they wanted her to be. She aced every test. She won every academic award the school offered. When the teacher assigned a chapter from a book, Faye went ahead and read the whole book, then read every book written by that author that was available at the town library. There was not a subject in which she did not excel. She was a model student, a model citizen, went to church, volunteered. Everyone said she had a good head on her shoulders. She was easily likable, a great listener, never demanding or critical. She was always smiling and nodding, always agreeable. It was difficult to dislike her, for there was nothing to dislike. She was accommodating, docile, self-effacing, compliant, easy to get along with. Her outward personality had no hard edges to bump into. Everyone agreed that she was really nice. To her teachers, Faye was the achiever. The quiet genius in the back of the room. They gushed about her at conferences, noting especially her discipline and drive. It was, Faye knew, all an elaborate mental game. She knew that way down deep she was a phony, just your average normal girl. If it seemed like she had abilities that no one else did, it was only because she worked harder, she thought, and all it would take for the rest of the world to see the real Faye, the true Faye, was one failure. So she never failed. And the distance between the real Faye and the fake Faye in her mind kept widening, like a ship leaving the dock and slowly losing sight of home. This was not without cost. The flip side of being a person who never fails at anything is that you never do anything you could fail at. You never do anything risky. There's a certain essential lack of courage among people who seem to be good at everything. Faye, for example, gave up the oboe. It goes without saying that she never played sports. Theater was an obvious no. She declined almost all invitations to parties, socials, mixers, afternoons at the river, nights drinking around a bonfire in somebody's backyard. She has to admit that now, as a result, she really has no close personal friends at all. Applying to Circle was the first risky thing she'd done in living memory, and then dancing the way she danced at the prom. And going after Henry the way she did at the playground. Risky. And now she felt punished for it. How the town resented her, and how Henry had shamed her. Such was the price for asserting herself. What had changed? What had inspired this new boldness? It was a line from this very poem, actually, the Ginsberg Sunflower poem, a line that seemed written exactly for her, a quick jolt that seemed to slap her awake. It summed up exactly how she felt about her life even before she knew she felt it. Poor dead flower. When did you forget you were a flower? When had she forgotten that she was capable of bold things? When had she forgotten that bold things bubbled constantly inside her? She flips to the back of the book and studies the author photo once again. There he is, this dashing young man, fresh-faced, his short hair lightly tousled, clean-shaven, wearing a baggy white shirt tucked in, and round tortoiseshell glasses that look like Faye's glasses. He's standing on a rooftop somewhere in New York. Behind him, the antennas of the city, and beyond those, the hazy shapes of skyscrapers. When Faye discovered that Ginsberg would be a visiting professor at Circle this coming year, she applied to the school immediately. She leans back against the brick wall. What would it be like to be in his presence, this man of such abundance? She worries about what she'd do in his class, freak out, probably, have a panic attack right there on the spot. She would be like the desolate narrator of the Sunflower poem. Unholy, battered old thing. But the orchestra is coming back now. The musicians are assembling, and Faye can hear them warming up. She listens to the cacophony. She feels it through her spine where she leans against the wall. And as she turns to press her cheek against the warm brick, she sees movement at the far end of the building. Someone has just rounded the corner. A girl. Light blue cotton sweater, intricately styled, blonde hair. It is, Faye sees, Margaret Schwingle. She's reaching into her purse, pulling out a cigarette, lighting it, blowing out that first drag with a delicate little phew. She has not yet seen Faye, but she will. It's only a matter of time, and Faye does not want to be caught doing what she's doing. Slowly, so as not to disturb the bushes around her, Faye reaches into her bag and replaces the Ginsberg collection with the first book she feels, The Rise of the American Nation, their history textbook. On the cover is a bronze statue of Thomas Jefferson surrounded by a monochrome of bright teal. She does this so that when Margaret finally notices her, which she quickly does, and walks over to her and says, "What are you doing?" Faye can respond, "Homework." "Oh," says Margaret, and this makes sense to her since everyone knows Faye to be a studious, hard-working, brainy, scholarship-getting girl. And thus Faye does not have to explain her deeper motives that she's here reading questionable poetry and pretending to be an oboist. "What homework?" says Margaret. "History." "Geez, Faye, boring." "Yeah, it really is," Faye says, though she does not find history boring at all. "It's all so boring," Margaret says. "School is so boring." "It's terrible," Faye says, but she worries that she sounds insincere, because of course she loves school, or maybe more accurately, she loves that she's good at school. "I cannot wait to be finished," says Margaret. "I want to be done." "Yeah," Faye says, "it won't be long." And this fact, the quickly coming end of the semester, has lately been filling her with dread, because she loves the clarity that school brings, the single-minded purpose, the obvious expectations, how everyone knows you're a good person if you study hard and score well in exams. The rest of your life, however, is not judged in this manner. "Do you read here a lot?" Margaret asks. "Behind the building?"
"Sometimes."
Margaret stares out at the black cornfield before them and seems to consider this. She puffs lightly on her cigarette. Faye follows her lead, stares blankly ahead, and tries to act aloof. "You know," says Margaret, "I always knew I was a special kid. I always knew I had certain talents, that everyone liked me." Faye nods, to agree, maybe, or to show she's listening, interested. "And I knew I'd grow up to be a special woman. I always knew that." "Uh-huh. I was a special child, and I grew up to be a special person."
"You are," Faye says.
"Thanks. I'd be a special woman who would marry a special man, and we'd have these great children, you know? I always thought that was going to be true. This was my destiny. Life was going to be comfortable. It was going to be great."
"It will be," Faye says. "All those things."
"Yeah, I guess," Margaret says. She smothers her cigarette in the soil. "But I don't know what I want to do with my life."
"Me neither," says Faye.
"Really? You?"
"Yeah, I have no idea."
"I thought you were going to college."
"Maybe. Probably not. My mom doesn't want me to. Neither does Henry."
"Oh," says Margaret. "Oh, I see. Maybe I'll put it off a year or two, wait for things to calm down."
"That might be smart."
"I might stay here a while longer."
"I don't know what I want," says Margaret. "I guess I want Jules."
"Of course.
Jules is great, I guess. I mean, he's really, really great."
"He's so great."
"He is, isn't he?"
"Yes."
"Okay," she says. "Okay, thanks."
And she stands, brushes off the dirt, and looks at Faye. "Hey, look, I'm sorry for being weird."
"It's fine," Faye says.
"Please don't tell anyone."
"I won't.
I don't think other people would understand."
"I won't tell anyone."
And Margaret nods and begins to leave when suddenly she stops, turns back to Faye.
"Would you like to come over this weekend?"
"Come over where?"
"My house, dummy. Come have dinner with us."
"Your house?"
"Saturday night. It's my father's birthday. We're having a surprise party for him. I want you to come."
"Me?"
"Yeah. If you're going to stay in town after graduation, don't you think we should be friends?"
"Oh, okay, sure," says Faye.
"Sure, that'd be swell."
"Great," says Margaret. "Don't tell anyone. It's a surprise."
She smiles and struts away, rounds the corner, and disappears. Faye leans back against the wall again and realizes the orchestra is going full tilt. She hadn't noticed. A big torso of sound, a big crescendo. She is overcome by Margaret's invitation. What a victory. What a shock. She listens to the orchestra and feels vast.
She finds that music muffled through a wall makes her more aware of the physicality of it, that when she can't hear the music exactly, she can still sense it, the vibrations, like waves, that buzz. The wall she presses her face to makes it a different kind of experience, no longer music but a crossing over of the senses. She is aware of the friction needed for music, the striking and stroking of string, wood, leather. Near the end of the piece, especially, when louder, she can feel the bigger notes, not abstract, but a quaking like a touch. And the feeling moves down her throat, a great pulse of noise now, a banging inside. It hums her. Beyond everything else, she loves this. How swiftly things can strike her. Music, people, life. How quickly they can surprise her, all of a sudden, like a punch. 6. Sometimes spring seems to happen all at once. Trees bloom, the first green shoots curl out of rain-muddy cornfields. Things are renewing, beginning, and for certain members of the graduating class, this is a time of hope and optimism. Commencement approaches, and the girls, those with steady boyfriends, those who daydream about weddings and gardens and toddlers, begin talking about soulmates, how they can feel it, destiny, the ineluctable hand of fate, how they just know. Soft, adoring eyes and a quiver in their pulse. Faye feels sorry for them, then sometimes sorry for herself. She seems to lack some essential romance in her life. To Faye, it all seems so arbitrary, love, all happenstance, as easily one thing as another, as easily one man as another. Take Henry. Why, of all men, Henry? The two of them sit on the riverbank one night throwing stones into the water, picking at the sand, nervously attempting wit and conversation, and this is what she's thinking. Why am I here with him? Simple. Because Peggy Watson started a dumb rumor last autumn. Peggy had come galloping to Faye after home ec, all smiles and high drama. I know a secret, she said, then teased Faye the rest of the day, slipping her a note in trigonometry. I know something you don't know. It's a good one, she said at lunch. Grade A juicy. Something to write home about. Tell me. It's better if you wait, she said, till after school. You want to be sitting down. Peggy Watson, vague friend since the third grade, house down the street, same bus ride home, the closest thing Faye has to a best friend. When they were children, they played this game where they used all the crayons in the box and whole pads of paper to write, I love you, in different colors, scripts, and designs. It was Peggy's idea. She couldn't stop. It never got old for her. Peggy's favorite was a picture of a heart with I love you written in a circle around it. A circle, so no beginning and no end, she said. Get it? It keeps going forever. After school that day, Peggy was ecstatic, exhilarated, with big rumors and alarming news. There's a boy who likes you. No, there's not, Faye said. There is, most definitely. I have it on good authority. Who told you? Lips are sealed, Peggy said. I swore up and down. Who's the boy? He's a boy in our class. Which one?
Guess.
I am not guessing.
Do it, guess.
Tell me. But Faye didn't really want to know. She didn't want the hassle. She was single, kept to herself, perfectly happy with that tableau. Why couldn't people just leave her alone?
Okay, Peggy said. Fine, no guessing, no games. I'll blurt it all out. Hope you're ready.
I am, Faye said. And she waited, and Peggy waited, savoring it, staring at Faye, full of mischief. And Faye suffered through the big theatrical pause until she could no longer bear it. Damn it, Peggy!
Okay, okay, she said.
It's Henry! Henry Anderson, he likes you!
Henry. Faye didn't know what she was expecting, but she was not expecting that. Henry? She'd never even considered him before. He was barely a presence in her thoughts. Henry, Faye said.
Yes, Peggy said. Henry, it's destiny. You two are destined. You wouldn't even have to change your last name.
I would, too. Anderson, Anderson, they're different. Still, Peggy said, he's pretty cute. Faye went home and locked herself in her room. Seriously considered, for the first time, having a boyfriend. Sat on her bed. Didn't sleep much. Cried a little. Decided by the next morning that, strangely, she actually cared for Henry a great deal. Had convinced herself that she'd always liked his looks. his sturdy linebacker physique, his quiet manner. Maybe she'd liked him all this time. At school, he seemed different now, more pink, alive, handsome. What she didn't know was that Peggy had done the same thing to him. Harassed him all day with hints about a certain girl who liked him. Revealed later that it was Faye. He came to school that day and saw Faye and couldn't understand why he'd never noticed how beautiful she was, how elegant and simple, what fierce eyes hid behind those big round glasses. They began dating shortly thereafter. Love is like this, Faye thinks now. We love people because they love us. It's narcissistic. It's best to be perfectly clear about this and not let abstractions like fate and destiny muddle the issue. Peggy, after all, could have picked any boy in the school. This is what's racing through her mind tonight on the riverbank, where Henry has brought her so he can, she believes, apologize. He's been timid ever since that night at the playground, the incident after the prom. They talk about it, but obliquely. They don't say anything specific. I'm sorry about... you know, he says, and she feels bad for him, the way he slumps over when addressing the subject. He's been irritatingly contrite and penitent, carrying her book bag home, walking a step behind her, head down, buying more flowers and candy. Sometimes, in fits of self-pity, he'll say things like, God, I'm so stupid! Or he'll ask her to go to the movies, and before she can accept, he'll say something like, if you still want to be my girl, that is. It's all arbitrary. Had Faye attended a different school? Had her parents moved away? Had Peggy been sick that day? Had she chosen a different boy? And on and on. A thousand permutations, a million possibilities, and almost all of them kept Faye from sitting here in the sand with Henry. He is a cauldron of nerves tonight, clenching and unclenching his hands, picking at the dirt, throwing rocks into the water. She sips a Coca-Cola out of the bottle and waits. He had planned it this far, getting Faye alone here on the riverbank. Now he doesn't know what to do. He wobbles back and forth in the sand, swats at something in front of his face, sits there hard and tense like a nervous horse. It irritates her, his torment. She drinks her Coke. The river smells of fish tonight, a damp and funky stench like spoiled milk and ammonia, and Faye thinks about this one time she was out with her father on his boat. He was showing her how to fish. This was important to him. He had grown up a fisherman. When he was a kid, that was his job. But she had no taste for it. She couldn't even hook the worm without crying. How it coiled around her finger and brown goo came spurting out as she pierced the skin. Henry reminds her of that worm right now, ready to pop. They stare at the river and the blue flame of the nitrogen plant, the moon, the light breaking on the water and scattering. A bottle bobs 10 yards out. A bug whizzes by her face. Waves come ashore in their rhythmic way, and the longer they sit here in silence, the more it seems to Faye like the river is breathing. How it contracts and expands, rushes in and rushes out, water caressing rocks as it pulls away. Finally, Henry turns to her and speaks.
Hey, listen, I want to ask you something.
Okay.
But I don't know if I can, he says. If I can ask you this.
Why not? She says. And she looks at him, sees him, and realizes she hasn't done that, actually looked at him. In how long? All night? She's been avoiding his eyes, embarrassed for him, hating him a little. And now she finds him grim and scowling.
I want to... he says, but stops. He never finishes the sentence. Instead, he leans quickly into Faye and kisses her. Kisses her hard. Like he did that night at the playground, and it surprises her. The sudden taste of him, his warmth pressing into her, the oily smell of his hands now clutching her face. It's shocking, his forcefulness, pushing his mouth to hers, driving his tongue past her lips. He's kissing like it's combat. She falls back into the sand and he pushes himself onto her, over her, still seizing her face, kissing wildly. He isn't rough exactly, but commanding. Her first impulse is to shrink away. He squeezes her, crushes his body into hers. Their front teeth knock together, but he keeps going. She never felt Henry so strongly and savagely male. She can't move under his weight and now she feels other of her body's demands. Her skin is cold, her belly full of cola, she needs to burp. Needs to wiggle out and run. And just at that moment he stops, draws back a few inches, and looks at her, Henry, she sees now, is in agony. His face is screwed up in knots. He's staring at her with big, pleading, desperate eyes. He's waiting for her to protest, waiting for her to say no, and she's about to, but she catches herself. And this will be the moment, later on in the night, after everything's over, after Henry has driven her home, as she stays awake till dawn thinking about it. The thing that will confuse her most is this precise moment, when she had the chance to flee, but she did not. She does not say no. She does not say anything at all. She simply meets Henry's gaze. Maybe, though she's not entirely sure of it, maybe she even nods yes. And so Henry goes back at it, vigor renewed, kissing her, tonguing her ear, biting her neck. He drives his hand down between them, and she hears the undoings of various mechanisms, belt and buckle, zipper. "Close your eyes," he says. "Henry, please close your eyes, pretend you're asleep." She looks at him again, his face inches away, eyes closed. He's consumed by something, some unutterable need. "Please," he says, and he takes her hand and guides it down. Faye pulls against him, weakly resisting until he says, "Please," again, and tugs harder, and she lets her hand go limp, lets him do what he wants. He draws himself out of his slacks and guides her hand the rest of the way, between the folds of his pants, under his briefs. When she touches him, he leaps. "Keep your eyes closed," he says. And she does. She feels him move against her, feels him slide across her fingers. It's an abstract feeling, removed from the world of actual things. He's pressing his face to her neck and pumping his hips, and she realizes he's crying, soft little whimpers, warm tears puddling where he's bearing into her. "I'm sorry," he says. Then Faye feels like she should be mortified, but mostly she feels pity. She feels bad for Henry, his despair and his guilt. The crude needs wrecking him, the hopeless way he's gone about it tonight. And so she pulls him closer and grips him tighter, and suddenly with a great shudder and a splash of warmth, it's all over. Henry collapses, groans, falls into her, and cries. "I'm sorry," he keeps saying. His body is curled up against her, and in her hand he's quickly shrinking away. "I'm so sorry," he says. She tells him it's okay. Strokes his hair slowly, holds him as the sobs ripple through his body. This cannot be what people mean when they talk about fate and romance and destiny. No, these things are ornaments, Faye decides, decorations hiding this one bleak fact, that Henry's master tonight was not love, but rather catharsis, plain old animal release. He whimpers into her chest. Her hand is sticky and cold. "True love," she thinks. And she almost laughs. 7. "There are two conditions," Margaret says, "for dinner at the Schwingles. First, pick up a package at the pharmacy, and second, tell no one." "What's in the package?" Faye says. "Sweets," Margaret says. "Chocolates and stuff, bonbons. My dad doesn't want me to have that kind of food. He says I need to watch my figure." "You don't need to watch your figure." "That's what I said. Don't you think that's unfair?" "That is so unfair." "Thank you," she says. She smooths her skirt, a gesture that seems inherited from her mother. "So, when you pick it up, can you pretend it's yours?" "Sure, of course." "Thank you. I already paid for it. I placed the order in your name so I wouldn't get yelled at." "I understand," Faye says. "The dinner is going to be a surprise for my dad, so when you see him at the pharmacy, tell him you're going on a date that night. With Henry. To throw him off the track." "Okay, I will." "Better yet, tell everyone you're going on a date that night."
"Everyone?"
"Yeah, don't tell anyone you're coming over."
"All right."
"If people know you're coming over, my dad could find out and he'd suspect something. I know you wouldn't want to ruin the surprise."
"Of course not."
"If you tell anyone, it will definitely get back to my dad. He's very well connected. You haven't told anyone yet, have you?"
"No."
"Okay, good, good. Just remember, pick up the package at the pharmacy and say you're going on a date with Henry." The party would be unforgettable. Margaret has promised balloons, streamers, her mother's famous salmon aspic, a cake with three different layers, homemade vanilla ice cream. Maybe afterward they would even take the convertible out for a nighttime joyride along the river. They feel so special to be singled out for the occasion.
Thank you for inviting me, she tells Margaret, to which Margaret gently touches her shoulder and says, I wouldn't have it any other way. On the evening of the party, Faye is in her bedroom trying to decide between two versions of the same dress. A smart little summer dress, one green, one yellow. Both were purchased for special occasions that Faye can no longer remember. Probably church-related. She looks into the mirror and holds one up in front of her, then the other. On her bed, spread out over the blankets and pillows, is paperwork from Chicago Circle. Documents and forms that will, once delivered, officially hold her seat in the freshman class of 1968. She'll need to put them in the mail within the next week to meet the deadline. She's already filled them out, in ink, in her neatest handwriting. Each night she's been spreading out the materials like this, the brochures and pamphlets, hoping something will speak to her, hoping to see something that will finally convince her to go or stay. Each time she feels near a decision, some worry compels her in the opposite direction. She'll read another Ginsberg poem and think, I'm going to Chicago. She'll look at the brochures and read about the space-age campus and imagine being in a place where the students are roundly smart and serious and wouldn't look at her all funny when she aces another algebra test, and she'll think, I'm definitely going to Chicago. But then she'll imagine how everyone in town would react if she went, or worse, if she came back, which is just about the most mortifying thing in the world. If she can't cut it at Circle and has to come back, then the whole town would be gossiping about her and rolling their collective eyes. She pictures this and thinks, I'm staying in Iowa. And so it goes, this awful pendulum. But she can make one decision at least, the yellow dress. Yellow feels like the more celebratory color, she thinks, the more birthday appropriate. Downstairs she finds her mother watching the news, a story about student protesters again. Another night, another university overrun. Students pack themselves into hallways and won't leave. They invade the office of the president and provost. They sleep there. Right where people work. She watches it on television, Faye's mother, gaping at the weird happenings in the world. On the couch, she sits and stares each night at Walter Cronkite. The events lately have seemed otherworldly, sit-ins, riots, assassinations. The vast majority of college students are not militant, explains the reporter. He interviews a girl with pretty hair and a soft wool sweater who tells him how much all the other students disagree with the extremists.
We just want to go to class and get good grades and support our boys overseas, she says, smiling.
Cut to a shot, wide angle of a hallway filled with students, bearded, long-haired, unkempt, shouting slogans, playing music.
Good Lord, says Faye's mother. Look at them. They're like hobos.
I'm going out, Faye says.
They probably started as nice boys, says her mother. They probably took up with the wrong crowd.
I have a date tonight. Her mother looks at her finally.
Well, you look very nice.
I'll be back by 10. She passes through the kitchen where her father is twisting off the top of the percolator. He's brewing coffee and fixing a sandwich in preparation for his Chemstar shift tonight. Bye, Dad, she says, and he gives her a quick wave. He's wearing his uniform, his gray jumpsuit with the Chemstar logo on the front, the interlocking C and S on the chest. She used to joke with him that if he removed the C, he'd look like Superman, but they haven't joked like that in a long time. She's opening the outside door when he stops her.
Faye, he says.
Yeah?
The guys at the factory are asking about you.
Faye pauses in the doorway, one foot in the house and one foot out. She looks back at her dad. They are? Why?
They're wondering about your scholarship,
he says as the percolator's top clatters off.
They're asking when you're leaving for college.
Oh.
I thought we agreed not to tell anyone.
They stand there in silence for a moment. Her father scooping spoonfuls of coffee grounds, Faye gripping the doorknob. It's not something you have to be ashamed of, she says. Me getting into college and getting a scholarship, that's not... What did you call it? Bragging? He stops fussing with the percolator then, and looks at her and smiles his tight smile. Puts his hands in his pockets.
Faye, he says.
That's just... I don't know what that is. Doing a good job. It's not bragging.
Doing a good job. Right. Does everybody get this scholarship?
No, of course not.
So you're special then. You're singled out.
I had to work hard, get good grades.
You had to be better than everyone else.
Yes, I did.
That's pride, Faye. Nobody is better than anyone else. Nobody is special.
It's not pride, it's reality. I got the best grades. I scored the highest marks. Me. It's an objective fact.
Do you remember the story I told you about the house spirit? The Nisa?
Yes.
And the little girl who ate the Nisa's meal?
I remember.
She wasn't punished because she stole his food, Faye. She was punished because she thought she deserved it.
You don't think I deserve to go to college?
He chuckles and looks at the ceiling and shakes his head.
You know, most fathers have it easy. They teach their daughters to value hard work and a day's wage, chase off the wrong boys, and buy an encyclopedia set. But you, you complain if a book is a poor translation.
What's your point?
Everyone already thinks you're a big shot. You don't have to go to Chicago to prove it.
That's not why I want to go.
Trust me, Faye. It's a bad idea, leaving home. You should stay where you belong.
You did it. You left Norway and moved here.
So I know what I'm talking about.
Do you think it was a mistake? Do you wish you'd stayed back there?
You don't understand anything.
I earned this.
What do you suppose is going to happen, Faye? Do you really believe that because you work hard, the world is going to be kind to you? You think the world owes you something? Because the world isn't going to give you a damn thing.
He turns around to attend to his coffee.
It doesn't matter how many straight A report cards you have, or where you go to college. The world is cruel.
Faye is still angry about this as she drives to the pharmacy. Angry at her father's cynicism. Angry that what always earned her the most praise, being a good student, is now the thing that makes her a target. She feels double-crossed by this, betrayed by some implicit promise made to her long ago. And she thinks maybe it's providence that she'll be seeing Mrs. Schwingle tonight, because if there's anyone in this entire town who would not accuse Faye of being pretentious, it is Mrs. Schwingle, who brags about her world travels and worships whatever new thing the elegant ladies of the East Coast are doing. Certainly Mrs. Schwingle, of all people, could sympathize. Faye arrives at the pharmacy and walks up to the counter, where she finds Harold Schwingle standing with a clipboard counting aspirin jars.
"Hi, Dr. Schwingle," she says.
He considers her sternly and coldly for what seems like an oddly long moment. He is tall and wide, his hair cut high and tight with military precision.
"I'm here to pick up my package," Faye says.
"Yes, I suppose you are."
He leaves and remains somewhere in the back room for what seems like far too long. Over the tinny speakers, a brass band plays a waltz. The automated air freshener releases a small poosh, and a few seconds later there's the cloying, perfumey odor of synthesized lilacs. There is nobody else in the pharmacy. The overhead lights flicker and buzz. On the counter, buttons for Richard Nixon's presidential campaign stare woodenly back at her. When Dr. Schwingle returns, he's carrying a dark brown paper bag, stapled shut. He drops it, and not particularly gently, on his side of the counter, too far away for Faye to comfortably reach it.
"Is this for you?" he says.
"Yes, sir."
"Will you swear to that, Faye? You're not buying this for someone else, are you?"
"Oh, no, sir, it's for me."
"You can tell me if it's for someone else. Be honest."
"Cross my heart, Dr. Schwingle. This is mine."
And he breathes in a dramatic way that reads as exasperation. Maybe disappointment.
"You're a good girl, Faye. What happened?"
"I'm sorry?"
"Faye," he says, "I know what this is. And I think you should reconsider."
"Reconsider?"
"Yes.
I'm going to sell this to you because it's my duty, but it's also my duty, my moral duty, to tell you I think it's a mistake."
"That's very nice of you, but a big mistake." She was not prepared for the intensity of this conversation.
"I'm sorry," she says, though she doesn't know what she's apologizing for.
"I always thought you were so responsible," he says.
"Does Henry know?"
"Of course," she says. "I have a date with him tonight."
"Do you?"
"Yes," she says, as instructed. "We're going out tonight."
"Has he proposed to you?"
"What?"
"If he were a gentleman, he would have proposed to you by now."
And Faye feels defensive under his criticism. What comes out sounds hollow.
"All in good time?" You really need to think about what you're doing, Fay.
Okay, thanks very much,
she says, and she leans over the counter and closes her fist around the brown paper bag with a loud, poignant crunch. She doesn't know what's happening here, but she wants it to be over.
Goodbye.
She drives quickly to the Schwingle House, a grand thing that sits on a rocky bluff overlooking the Mississippi River, a rare point of elevation in the otherwise gentle rolling flatness of the prairie. Faye drives up through the trees to the house, which she finds unexpectedly dark. The lights are off and everything is silent. Faye panics. Did she get the date wrong? Were they meeting somewhere else first? She's considering driving back home and calling Margaret when the front door opens and out she walks, Margaret Schwingle, in sweatpants and a baggy t-shirt, hair disheveled in a way Faye has never seen before, scooped to one side like she's been sleeping on it.
Do you have the package? She asks.
Yes, Faye gives her the crinkly brown bag. Thanks. Margaret, is everything okay?
I'm sorry, she says. We can't have dinner tonight.
Okay.
You have to go home now.
Are you sure you're all right? Margaret is staring at her feet, not looking at Faye.
I'm really sorry. For everything.
I don't understand.
Listen, she says, and now she looks at Faye for the first time. She stands up straight and points her chin out, trying to look tough. Nobody saw you come here tonight.
I know.
Remember that. You can't prove you were here.
Then Margaret nods to Faye and spins on her heel and leaves, locking the door behind her.
8. In 1968, in Faye's small Iowa River town, the girls of the graduating class knew, though they never spoke of it, dozens of ways to get rid of unplanned, unwanted, unborn children. Some of these methods were almost always unsuccessful, some were nothing more than old wives' tales, some required advanced medical training, some were too horrible to think about. The most attractive were, of course, those that could be done innocently, without any special chemical.